I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Josina Michelle, the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice with an international reach for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence. A survivor of such violence herself, she is in Indianapolis to speak at an event tonight for Saving Orphans Through Healthcare and Outreach, SOHO. Please join the conversation with Josina Michelle. You can call 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today, this is a special No Limits, we're going to be talking today with Josina Michelle. She is the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice with an international microphone on behalf of those who have suffered and survived domestic violence. She is joined by John Molefe, who is the chief executive officer of Kaluka, the organization they founded to deal with these issues. I'd like to welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here, and I'd also like to invite our listeners to join this conversation by calling 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So we're going to be talking about some very heavy and important stuff, obviously, in this discussion. I thought I'd start with on a slightly more pleasant note and welcoming you to Indiana and to Indianapolis. Is it your first time here?
No, it is actually my second time. I was here 2 years ago. More or less around the SOHO event as well, and I was honored at the time with a Trailblazers Award.
John, is it your first time, or were you here?
Yeah, it is my first time here, and it's a beautiful city, I must say. There's something nice about the feel of it. It's open, it's green, and the people are very friendly, which is very nice.
Well, it is good to have you here, and those pleasantries out of the way. I think we can talk. I want to talk first because I want people to understand, Josina, some of your journey. It's not like you planned to set out and make this a significant portion of your life's work. Can you talk a little bit about what brought you here? I know your story, but you tell it better than I would.
Sure. I was brought up, I was born into a family of revolutionaries and change makers in our continent, particularly in Mozambique. My father was Samora Machel, my mother Graça Machel, who was the very first Minister of Education in Mozambique. And later on, I was raised in the house of Nelson Mandela as a daughter. So it is quite uncommon. Mm-hmm. I was always involved in social causes. I think it's one of those things that I ended up drinking from my parents, you know, the social consciousness and knowing that one needs to use one's life to the betterment of others as much as it can. But I was in the area of gender issues, HIV and women's development. But at no point I imagined that, you know, the issue of gender-based violence would be mm-hmm. so personal to me. And, so three years ago, on October 17th, 2015, the person I was seeing at the time, got extremely aggravated for reasons that are still not being clarified. We were inside a car and he beat me severely to, you know, in the forehead, the one that hit on the eye that erupted my eye right there and there, rendered me blind for the rest of my life. and a third blow to the back that, you know, was really the message that said, get out of the car. And that's how I started this journey. I started screaming for help immediately. As soon as I was assisted at the hospital, I said I'd been abused, I'd been beaten up, and clarified who had beaten me up. I then spoke to the police. But because the injury was so, so really damaging, I had to take some time out to see whether we could reconstruct the retina, the nerve, you know, the nerve at the back and so on. So only 3 weeks later, I was able to start the actual process in court and, of course, validating and reiterating what I had said. And that has taken me to where I am today, because in that period, I realized that things like power, influence, corruption, not adequate services are reality to millions of women. Rather, they're another brutality to millions of women. And although I came from a situation of privilege, I went through exactly what millions and millions of women go through when it comes to accessing services, the way they are treated by the practitioners, situations where your documents disappear. And so you need to relate the story once and twice and thrice until it gets heard and is taken to court. So that is what then created Kutluka Movement, because I thought, you know, there have to be institutions that actually cater for survivors of violence or victims of violence at that point and be able to regenerate and heal them until they become survivors of violence.
So, and I want to dive into this larger subject, but to continue, your attacker, if my research is correct, you know, was given a suspended sentence, correct, or am I mistaken?
Yes, was given a suspended sentence.
Which had to have been frustrating because it not to put too fine a point on it, he almost beat you to death, right?
You said it. Yes, he got a suspended sentence, which is actually half of what a normal sentence for this kind of of trauma and this type of crime actually goes for. Then, you know, there's still quite a lot of issues to be resolved in this case because, you know, everybody appeals then they go into appeal, and appeals take as long as it is. So, yes, there was justice because the person was convicted in that sense. But in terms of punitive measures and so on and so forth, no, nothing has happened.
So, and this is the part where I think the story gets fascinating. And I should say as a backdrop, in my days as a newspaper reporter, I did a fair amount of reporting on the issue of domestic violence, and what I discovered out of that experience is that the pool of people who have experienced it is as vast as the ocean. And that we know so little about it because so few people The feelings, the emotions connected with it are so intimate and touch us at so many vulnerable places that it is hard to drag the subject to the surface. At what point out of this experience, when you had to have been feeling pretty battered and betrayed, did you decide that you wanted to make it part of your work to drag this subject to the surface and start talking about it?
Well, John, I think I did start talking about it, perhaps in a kind of an unconscious way, because when I immediately was taken to a hospital, I spoke out. I said I'd been beaten up, and I had to repeat that three times so that you know, I am heard properly. And then they ask who beat me up and so on. So that was the first interface with actually speaking out, because there was an amount of information that was out, and people knew that this had happened to Grasa Machel's daughter, who's the daughter of Samara Machel, and, you know, and daughter to Nelson Mandela. So the moment I went out and I said, I was beaten. There was a piece of information that was mm-hmm. out already, and it meant having spoken out. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I did have the option later on of not making it public in terms of going to newspapers mm-hmm. and speaking out. I could have perhaps just decided to be silent and go through my injuries and going through my own healing in the privacy of those that are close to me. But I don't think that is not who I am. Mm-hmm. That is not who I am. It came naturally to me to say, you know, this is what happened. This is a crime. And people should not be kept in the closets for doing this kind of things. I was perhaps not too aware of the kind of backlash mm-hmm. that can happen in situations like that, where a woman is then faced with doubt. People openly start asking you, what have you done? What mm-hmm. did you do? What did you say that made him so angry? As if actually there's something that you say, oh, no. Oh, yeah, well, mm-hmm. that was really too bad. You should have been beaten up for that. But that was, I think, the first step of coming out. But then it was where I was convicted. I was convinced that something really had to be done was when I had to go back and try to get the documents, for example, my medical records at the hospital, and I realized that the medical records had disappeared. Mm. And then go to the police to get the case number and so on, and the records had disappeared. And so it meant that I had to go up and down, you know, looking and speaking to people, speaking to doctors, making sure they could write some kind of report. The first reports that we're reading were appalling. It didn't actually describe half of what, I mean, it didn't describe 25% of what I'd been, mm-hmm. What I'd looked like when I went to the hospital and what treatment I required. And in that, I had to do easily 7 trips just to recover one document. And that was the time when I said, no, if this is happening to me, then what happens to Mary?
Yeah, someone who is probably as well connected as one can be. Right?
Exactly. And if that happens to me, then, I mean, what is the reality of other women? And so, yes, that was the stage in which this turn came and said, you know what, I'm going to speak out and I'm going to make sure that using my voice, using my face, I can help mobilize resources. And resources is not just financial, it's human resources, is capital, human capital, to mobilize against gender-based violence. So that we can combat and end gender-based violence. And in it, we can create safe spaces for women to regenerate and to heal. You know, there are many women. I mean, in South Africa, we say that it's 1 in 3. But I just realized that here in the United States, it's around 1 in 4. Mm-hmm. And these are cases of
people that... If those numbers are even accurate.
If those are correct, exactly. Yeah. Because these are cases that are reported. Mm-hmm. So we need to think about the ones that have not found the courage yet to talk, to tell their stories. And the ones that, you know, they're still trapped in all these relationships and they're just too afraid to do so.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Josina Michelle, who is the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and an international voice for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. John, I feel like I've been ignoring you here. how do you enter this story?
My role comes in as working with Josina to really take the commitment and passion that she has around, you know, doing something about, you know, gender-based violence and working together to build an organization that is structured and has program that assists in the health and social development response, both in, you know, in South Africa, Mozambique, and we want to extend to other countries. So we are working on an organization called Kutluga Movement, which mobilizes women and men, so that we are able to at the first level, you know, prevent more cases of domestic violence happening. And that happens in a form of dealing with policies, dealing with the cultural practices that actually enables, you know, the environment for that for violence against women to happen, but also provide, you know, a response that is mitigates once the women are faced with this unfortunate situation. They are able to come up with solution to help them immediately, but also to assist them in the long-term process of healing.
We are talking with Josina Michelle, who's the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice with an international reach for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence. She is joined by her partner in this work, John Malefe of Kaluka Movement. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a special No Limits today. We are talking with Josina Michelle, who is the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice with an international microphone. On behalf of those who have suffered and survived domestic violence, she is such a survivor herself. She is joined by the chief executive officer, John Malefe, of Kaluka Movement, which is the organization she formed on behalf, really, of people who are dealing with domestic violence. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So we have talked about sort of the path that led you to this point. And I'm going to start with Josina. One of the things that, and I'd like for you to talk a little bit about this, about the relationship that you have developed with what I've called this kind of hidden ocean of people out there. One of the things I knew when I was writing about these issues that stunned me were the number of people who would come up. And sometimes it was women. More often it would be children who said, you know, this was happening in my home and, you know, I can't tell you the way it shaped my life. And they found something, just the fact that somebody would speak to these issues, that it was brought out there, they found liberating. I cannot imagine what it is like when you began speaking out, the kind of people who began approaching you and saying, you know, I'm glad you're doing this or whatever. Could you speak to what those relationships have been like with other people who have survived or witnessed?
Yes, of course. You know, one of the things that brings me a kind of a bittersweet, it always takes me into a bittersweet space, is when I am, for example, in the most unexpected of places, sometimes in shopping malls, for example, a woman comes and says, "Hi, and I would like to tell you how much you have helped me." And they explain the situation in which they are. Some have left abusive relationships. Others are still in abusive relationships. But they feel comfortable to share their story with someone they know will believe them. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I've learned from my experience, is that people want to share with, and they want to feel that someone understands what they're going through, at least understand the complexity of the issues and the personal dilemmas that they're going through. You know, the fact that someone has left an abusive relationship doesn't mean that 6 months later the person is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still a personal, a psychological, and an emotional struggle to actually be able to deal, let me say, perhaps with those demons, with the trauma that is caused, and be able to live normally or create a new normal in their lives, you know, that is conducive to have a productive life. Because, you know, the issue of post-traumatic stress is really something of crazy in the mind, if I can say that. You know, small little things that sometimes might we might not notice, or others may not notice, and can immediately trigger a response. And that response may be fear, may be panic, may be just simple days, you know, and you never know when it happens. You really never know when it happens. But it's, you know, what is very saddening, John, is that human beings have managed to go through and overcome that, you know, immense adversity. We have gone through wars and we managed to end it. You know, genocides. We have, you know, we have managed to abolish slavery. So, I mean, deep issues. But we still find ourselves in 2018 and we are having half of the population of this world still being oppressed, still being harassed, still being raped, still being killed. And there's not actually a sense of an uproar yet. There's not a sense of declaring this a crisis for humanity. Because, yes, if some women don't go through it, let's say on the physical signs, the emotional issue is always there. You know, knowing that my sister or knowing that my friend has been abused touches me and will change and also affects the way I will relate to my children. So it's the trauma that passes through generation from generation. I mean, women are not able to walk in the streets freely in this world in general because, you know, there's the whole issue of harassment. They don't know if they're wearing a short skirt, what will it lead to, you know? You can't walk freely in certain places because it's dark and it's almost as an invitation for rape to occur. Or you're drinking, you are at a place and you're just having a social life. And you know that, you know, if anything happens to you at that time, the question will be, how much did she drink? Oh, she doesn't know about, she doesn't remember. How can we live in a world like this?
It's almost as if you're channeling, you're probably aware, we're having a huge national debate in this country right now about these issues, about, you know, who should be believed and who shouldn't be believed. Yeah. And I'm not, you're more than welcome to comment directly on that if you wish, but that isn't where I was trying to lead you. I think I want to talk a bit about this question of belief.
Yeah.
Why has it been so hard for our culture? Or, well, it's not just Western culture, it's all cultures, basically, to believe women when it comes to this. I mean, in this case, you know, it sounds like there was even some skepticism in your situation. And, you know, as you say, you're now blind in one eye. That was a severe beating. What is it that, where does that disconnect occur, do you think, that people cannot believe this is happening?
Let me dare to think or to say that perhaps the disconnect has always existed. And it comes from very long ago. You know, we can go centuries and centuries. And I mean, until very recently, women were always treated as children. It's only really in modern times that women have had access to voting, which until then it was like, yeah, women don't have the capacity to think. You know, they're not the capacity to vote. They're too emotional. They're not rational. And it comes, it stems from that. It's generations of generations. And it is very sad that in spite of all the victories in women's movements, this is something that hasn't happened yet, is to get real to a level of equality between men and women. And so when these kind of issues, you know, when a woman comes out and talks about sexual harassment, rape, and abuse, it's always easier for everybody to say, did it really? And let's listen to him. It's always the man that has to be taken first seriously. And either he says, well, I did it.
Look at the damage you're doing to his life or whatever.
Look at the damage that you're doing to his life, right? But hello, where does this come from? It has been, it's one of those ultimate victories in human development that I think we still have to achieve, in which a man immediately stands at a position of non-guilty until proven so, whereas a woman, ultimately, I mean, she stands out and she says, I was abused. But the first question that comes up, what did you do?
Mm-hmm. So the assumption, you're arguing, the assumption of guilt is on the other side.
The assumption of guilt is always on the other side. And she needs to go through extreme circumstances and detaching herself almost from the emotional aspect and be very clinical about what happened in recollecting exactly how it happened to the detail. Because you might actually feel, if you hear into a story, you'll say, oh, no, this really sounds very plausible, makes sense. But she didn't get right the fact that, you know, at that particular time, this and this wasn't there. And that whole, just the fact that that misses, it can actually, you know, invalidate her old story, invalidate her own experience.
John, what do you why do you think it is that that there is this desire to minimize this problem and to really to sweep it under the rug, to pretend that it just does not exist?
John, you know, we come from a patriarchal society, you know, all over the world. And therefore, the patriarchy, you know, dictates that, you know, the man is at the top. And once you start, you know, challenging that, or you start asking questions around having women's rights to be taken as equal to those of men's rights, you're challenging, you know, the equilibrium, and therefore there is discomfort in that. And there will always be resistance. And unfortunately, with the resistance of something that is ingrained in the way we live, is that resistance happens consciously by some people that actually still believe that things have to stay the same, but others subconsciously, because you take it as normal, you take it as how things should be, and subconsciously you think that once a woman says, I do not agree with the treatment that a man is giving me, you think that this person is creating a problem, and therefore how do we, you know, stop it? And that is why then it be, you know, the whole idea of not believing her, it's just resistance to change. And that's why these things are layered and much more complex. It's not just about what she's saying. It's not just about the incident. It's much, much more complex and challenges the whole patriarchal system.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Josina Michelle. She is the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence, as she has done herself, and John Malefe, who is works with her at Kaluka Movement, which deals with these issues. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Jacina, I want to talk about, because it struck me, one of the transformative forces in the life of the world over the past century to half century has been something relatively simple. And that is the power of testimony. I mean, just speaking to one's experience, speaking to either the justice or injustice of one's experience. What do you gain, do you think, from speaking to your experience? And what do you think other people gain from you offering what amounts to your testimony?
I having gone through what I went and being able to give my testimony has allowed me on a personal
And I don't
level,
mean legal testimony, by the way. I'm
yes,
talking about
but telling
testimony
my story
in a broader sense, yes.
Exactly, yes. But telling my story has been liberating for me, you know. But most important, has led me to a situation where I look beyond my own personal drama, but I've learned to understand actually in the skin what it is that millions of women go through, the challenges, the horrors, the re-victimization. And that is why my offer is to say, okay, we're offering space, safe spaces through Kutluka where women can go. It's shelters that we are building where women can go and they have access to multiple services in just one place. It's a bit difficult to say what other women gain, but I would think that at least they can look at their own battles and say, okay, that is not specific to me. That happens across the board. It doesn't matter what your level of education is. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white. It doesn't matter what kind of family you come from or what kind of job you have. The reality is that it happens. It can happen to me. It can happen to my sister. It can happen to my mother. It can happen to my daughter. And so our duty is ensure that at least we create a world in which it does not happen to our granddaughters and to our sons.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Josina Michelle and John Malefe about domestic violence, domestic abuse. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Greg has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Greg, you're on the air. Greg, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to the program. It's a very good program, and they're definitely spot on. And I just want to say that women experience it definitely, but men experience it as well. Mm-hmm. I had a situation just like that, and it was actually at the workplace. But here's the I was wondering if she recognized what the real underpinning problem is.
We will see.
Because what I'm hearing is that they're the symptoms.
Yeah.
What it is the irrational anger that just goes in all different directions. And like you, I think you indicated, you said, well, I wonder why we can't resolve. It's because it's a mental health situation.
Let me see if I can get an answer for you, Greg. Thanks very much for the call and the question. Josina.
Hi, Greg. Thank you, and thank you for being so honest. You know, we concentrate this conversation today mainly on the issues of women, perhaps because it is the most pervasive, and it's almost naked to the eye. But I do recognize the horrors that men go through in the hands of other men. And, you know, it's the issue of abuse is really intrinsically about power. And power that you can act, you can express on others, on those that you think are powerless and that can be, that can be acted upon. I think the bottom line is anger, and I mean it's power, and that is something that both men and women have to actually deal with and change.
And that's a big subject. So, and I could tell you, we're coming up on a break, and I could tell you we're rushing to get through it. We can pick it up on the other side. We are talking about domestic violence, domestic abuse with Josina Michelle. She is the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence. And John Malefe, who works with her at Kaluka Movement, which deals with those issues. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today on No Limits with Chosina Michelle, the stepdaughter of the late Nelson Mandela and a voice for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence, as has she. She's in town for an event tonight for Saving Orphans Through Healthcare and Outreach, otherwise known as SOHO. She's joined by John Malefe, who works with her at Kaluka Movement that deals with many of these issues, helps people who are facing them. Before we went to the break, Greg asked a question really about the roots, and I could tell we were kind of rushing because it's a big question. We came right up against it. I think what I... If it's okay, Greg, I'm going to reframe your question ever so slightly and talk about how we break this cycle, because you probably know even better than I do. Most of the studies show that those who either have suffered or have grown up in homes where domestic violence occurs are far more likely to commit it themselves. So it becomes sort of a circle, a self-perpetuating, a machine that runs by itself. How do we break that cycle? What steps must we take? John, I'll throw that one to you first because I saw Josina giving you a significant look there as if to say, okay, this one's yours.
Yeah, and I think that's what is important, actually. Part of mitigating and preventing this is to break the cycle. Mm-hmm. And it's critical that we understand that some of the how it manifests itself is that gender equality is at the center of it. Mm-hmm. Gender inequality is at the center of it. So if we bring up our boys and girls in an environment where they actually respect each other, they understand that they are equals as human beings. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it should be able to assist in a way to making sure that as they grow up or when they get into relationships, they get into relationships as equals. So there is no right to dominate, or there is no right to control, mm-hmm. and use your power to control. Secondly, is that also it's a human rights issue. We need to actually, get our people to understand the human rights culture. And once you understand that living in a human rights culture, you understand that every person has got rights, to same rights and equal rights with you. But lastly is the issue of violence. We come from a violent past. We are a violent society. And if young people grow up in families where they see violence as a means to sort out a conflict, that's how they actually, and it plays it out itself, when they grow up. There's research that shows that young people growing up in families where they see, maybe the father, assaulting the mother, they hate it. They mm-hmm. hate it with passion, and they will express it. But when they are confronted with a situation which challenges them, mm-hmm. and the default position is to go in what has been internalized as a way of dealing with violence. So we need to understand that violence perpetuates violence, and therefore we need to actually stop that so that, our children also grow up not in an environment where their default position when there is a difference is to go into violence.
Josina, you said, when you first began to speak on these issues and to offer your testimony, that there was a backlash. Could you talk about the nature of that backlash and what it was like to experience that?
It was quite vicious because a number of things were, a number of issues were raised. First, on whether it was right to take something that is supposedly private and take it into the public sphere. The second one was, of course, the issue of credibility, mm-hmm. of what was she doing, where was she, what could she have done to come across such violence. It was also the issue of a broader expectation that because I come from a public family, I and the family had the responsibility of keeping this kind of issues, such as violence against women and abused, inside its family and deal with it and not take it to the public arena. So there were different kinds of, there was quite a lot of viciousness in the attack, but it was overcome. The most important is it's something that it's openly talked about now, and it's not in hush-hush tones.
Who were the people who expressed that violence or that viciousness, as you say? Where did that come from?
From various segments of society. It was from various segments of society. It was from religious leaders, political leaders, journalists, social activists
journalists
as well.
Human beings.
Sorry,
too,
I looked at you and I had to smile. That's why I said that. No, but it came from all spheres of society, really, and also from a family level. You know, there's certain people inside. I mean, in the extended, extended family and friends, they thought, yeah, but we should not be talking about this. Let's deal with it and not
like
go on.
It's like airing our dirty
so,
laundry.
Exactly, it
yes.
is, and families do go through that. I mean, mine have been in a public sphere, but every family has to then grip with the effect of what happened and decide, okay, how do we handle it? And we know there are many cases in which families decided, okay, let's not talk about it. Let's keep it up. Well, it's been happening for generations. My mother went through that. My grandmother went through that. And look, we're still here. So that was it. But the most important is that, you know, the issue of gender-based violence is something that is openly discussed in our societies. I mean, there is, yes, of course, there can be some backlash, but the enormity of it and the numbers have forced it really to be part of our daily news. It's something that we discuss now in our social circles.
We've gotten a question from a listener who did not want to go on the air. He says... taking off on my comment about abusers learning from past experience, seeing abuse, the caller wants to also add that women who are abused are more likely to get abused again. What do the guests think about that, Josina?
I totally agree with that. It does happen. And if we look in particular, I mean, in many cases, women, before they actually break completely from the abuser, there's an average of 4 or 6 times in which a woman goes back to the abuser.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, yes. And the tendency is if there is no healing and regenerating somewhere in the process, and women needing to understand exactly what is inside of them, the brokenness that has happened inside of them that continues to attract this kind of abuse and people that perpetrate abuse on them. So I totally agree. It does happen. And that is part of the work that Kutluka aims to do. It's really to regenerate, allow women to go through services, psychosocial services, in an environment that is safe, so that they can become, you know, they can mend their brokenness, and they can be, they look at themselves differently, they feel themselves different, and the kind of relationships that they get into after that can actually be different from what they were.
How much of this, and I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on this, is really that we need to understand more about the complexity of human experience. And by that, I mean that, the assumption is that a woman, and we'll say it's a woman, although, as you've pointed out, particularly in same-sex marriages, domestic abuse
Indeed.
Is often a reality, too, that a woman is battered and should immediately realize and run away or get out of that relationship. But we forget that, whatever other feelings there may be there, whether they are feelings of betrayal, anger, and all of that, some of the forces, some of the feelings that first drew you toward that person are still present. And it creates for a very complicated set of responses. I'll let John speak first on that one, but then I'll come back to Josina on it.
Yeah, John, you know, you picked up on an important thing that, you know, even though we're trying to break this down, we need to know that these things are layered. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex situation, and every situation has got its own layers that, you know, put, you know, a lot of pressure and make it manifest itself in a particular way. You find that when a woman is in that situation, sometimes you see that, you know, the signs that this is going to actually lead. Sometimes you actually don't see those signs. Mm-hmm. But as you said, you know, you find somebody because of the pressure of religion, for example. You know, religion plays a role in pressurizing. You know, I can tell of Christianity sometimes that they expect you to stay in a relationship. It's a shame to get divorced, and therefore, because of that pressure, you stay on in there. You are a woman, you are told that you're supposed to build a family. In some cultures, it's a role, it's a responsibility of a woman to build a family. So when you see that there is a risk of a break in that relationship, you try by all means to actually build, and therefore you keep on staying in there because you blame yourself. And at times it's also economic pressures. You know, you worry about, you know, if I get out of this, how will I survive? How will my children actually survive? So these things are actually layered that actually ultimately put pressure on a woman to actually stay in those kind of relationships.
Josina, your thoughts?
Definitely very complex, and not something that we do take lightly. It is a cultural issue. It's human nature also. We do not want to be involved. When we get involved in these relationships, what we envisage is not a breakage. Mm-hmm. It's not breaking it down. And there is always that sense of, I need to make it work. I have to make it work. Our sense actually of success and definition is to making sure that those things that we stand for 100% actually become successful. And the time it takes to then realize that, listen, this kind of situation is actually damaging to me. It can be life-threatening. Mm-hmm. It's one process, but then the emotions are still there, as you said. You know, I was talking and was reminded the other day of the Stockholm Syndrome, in which women, in which people who are heavily abused and their lives are in threat, somehow even develop a kind of relationship with the abuser, with the perpetrator. And so it's not something that we take that lightly, and we look for solutions, and these kind of solutions cannot come just from one angle. We need the participation, the collaboration of all spheres of society, being the private sector, being the NGO sector, being the political sector, and of course, citizen agency. Only when we look at our society and we say, we cannot take this anymore, we need to stop, we cannot tolerate, then we're going to have social change.
We have gotten an email from a listener named Mary, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Says you, meaning I'm assuming me, asked why there is this issue of women being believed. True that often they are not, but so often they are, but it is treated as if it is no big deal or their own fault. I think in many ways this is even more destructive and belittling than not being believed. You're nodding your head in affirmation, Josina.
Yes, I am, because it is, you know, it's a level of, it's second victimization when a woman has the courage to go up and talk about it, and then she's belittled. You know, her feelings and her accounts are not taken seriously. In fact, they are told in many times, you come and deal with this later. Go sort it out. But are you sure this is exactly what happened? And, you know, and let me just quickly mention, we just had a case here in with the Kavanaugh issue, in which she was actually asked, how sure are you that that happened? And her answer was 100%.
Mm-hmm. And that's another, we've got another listener who didn't want to go on the air. And I've sort of resisted dragging the conversation in the way of Kavanaugh, because felt like it would demean or diminish your own experience to do that. But they want the listener wants you to talk about that, what perspective you have on what is going on with Brett Kavanaugh and, you know, now several accusers of inappropriate behavior.
Look, their behavior are somehow a reflection of what's happening in our society. It happens at different levels. I mean, it happens in churches and so on. And what is being what we're witnessing now is actually happening in other. It's happening in higher spheres of power. But what are, I mean, those are men like us. I mean, like any or any other man. And they're just really showing what has been allowed throughout their lives and getting away with it. And now they get to a position of a lot more power in which they can say, no, almost deleting everything that has happened, not taking responsibility, not being accountable for things they have done, and, of course, continuing the subjugation of women and continuing at that level, entrenching, you know, feelings but perceptions that women are not responsible. Women can come and fabricate evidence of issues that are deep and they are real in our lives. So really, unfortunately, I think it just, we need to look at it and say, okay, it is happening. It's just too visible. And how does it really apply in our lives? And it's an opportunity for us to learn and to accept that we will not have this kind of case again and again and again. And things don't really change intrinsically.
So, and I realize this is sort of the eternal question on this. I mean, power rarely surrenders itself. How do we get past this moment? And unfortunately, I've only given you about 45 seconds to answer that really
power needs
large
to be
question.
Taken. And women and men that know that fight for equality have to take the power. How do we take the power? We transform institutions. We transform the environment in which we live. And we're very conscious of who we elect as our leaders. But power can change. It will never be given, but it is taken.
That sounds to me like an appropriate last word for us. I don't think we're going to improve upon that. You are speaking this evening, right?
At
the Soho event. Do you plan to come back for this every couple of years? Because if so, I would really hope that the two of you would come back here and join us again. I have really enjoyed this conversation. I've learned a lot from the two of you.
Thank you. We hope to be in touch. Yes, we feel like Indianapolis is a kind of home. We would love to come back. Thank you for
that. And I hope you would include No Limits on your itinerary then the next time you would come back.
Absolutely. So, thanks for hosting us.
And I would like to thank, to make this formal, my guest, Josina Michelle, an international advocate for those who have suffered and survived domestic violence, and John Malefe, who works with her at Kaluka Movement, which deals with those issues. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.